From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. Today on Dialogue, we're exploring a reality that exists at a complex crossroads of identity and belonging, the experiences of Black undocumented immigrants in the United States.
Within days of taking office, President Trump launched an aggressive crackdown on illegal and legal immigration. It has featured high-profile raids, some controversial deportations, and a showdown with the courts.
ICE raids in Los Angeles, here in Chicago, and across the country are prompting a big backlash to the Trump administration's immigration crackdown.
New this morning, President Trump's sweeping new travel ban is now in effect. As of midnight, citizens from 12 countries, mostly in Africa and the Middle East, are now barred from entering the United States.
In 2025, immigration, DEI, and DACA have all been contentious topics. We've seen certain images and narratives dominate our national conversation. But today, we're focusing on those whose stories often go untold, the estimated 600,000 Black immigrants who live in this country without documentation, navigating a system that sees them through multiple lenses of marginalization.
ICE 2025 has seen a lot of new laws and ICE activity from the second Trump administration. Before we get into the realities of Black undocumented individuals, we need to set a framework for the immigration process in the United States. To learn more, I spoke with Maria Jimenez. She's the executive director and a case manager at the nonprofit Immigration Services of Champaign-Urbana, or ISCU.
Immigration is a spectrum. People are and have been immigrating for all sorts of different reasons. It is more often than not in pursuit of a better life. But I think what we're seeing now is individuals fleeing persecution, fleeing government corruption, fleeing extreme poverty, gang-related violence to where militias and gangs are actually infiltrating the government itself, which is why I spoke to government corruption, and just general violence that creates a really uninhabitable environment for immigrants. And they really are left in a position that nobody wants to be in of, do I need to flee my home? Do I need to flee my land? And I think it's important to really emphasize that somebody more often than not is not going to leave their land unless they really need to. So the process of immigrating legally, I think there's a very, very large misconception amongst more conservative minded people that it's an easy process, right? That like you basically just like apply for it, you pass an exam and you're good to go. And the immigrants are just negligent and do not want to follow that process. Applying to be a legal resident of this country can be close to impossible. I won't go into all the legality of it, but it is very, 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 very difficult. What we're really seeing now, and the emphasis of why immigration is such a big topic right now, is because of asylum. So as I was speaking earlier to government corruption, to all of these different reasons why somebody might say, okay, my home has become uninhabitable for me and my family, the U.S. accepts asylum, or right now they're not. They had in the past. So a lot of these immigrants were actually migrating to the southern border of the United States, turning themselves into the authorities and saying, I would like to seek asylum. Upon turning themselves in, there's a couple of different things that might happen. They might get an ankle bracelet put on them. They might get put into a detention center. They might be torn apart from their family and their children, or they might be moved into or given a flight or something like that into the home of a person who's willing to sponsor them, and they're able to provide an address that says, I'm going to go live with this person. That does not mean that they are immediately granted asylum. That means that from that moment on, they are handed a very, very heavy packet of legal documents that says you have to present yourself at court. And essentially, you are in removal proceedings until you can file for asylum and prove that you qualify for asylum. There's a lot of financial instability-based implications that come with filing for asylum. So a lot of what we do in our organization, ISCU, and obviously that's changed a little bit, is to try to keep people stabilized as they are seeking that asylum. So do you have stable housing? Are you able to find some kind of work? Are you able to settle into a certain place, and are your children able to go to work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then there's refugee status, which is different because as opposed to filing for the asylum once you are already migrated into the United States, that's typically done in the government of whatever country you're for. There has to be understanding between the United States and whatever country is giving those refugee statuses. And then typically the person already comes with some sort of ability to work, some kind of status that allows them to mobilize themselves a little bit more quickly, but even then it can be very difficult. So those are the main ones that we interact with and we see the most.
The intersection of diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI work, with the experiences of Black undocumented immigrants represents a critical but often overlooked area where marginalization can take place. Black undocumented immigrants face unique challenges due to the intersection of their racial identity, immigration status, and often other factors like language barriers, cultural differences, or socioeconomic circumstances. This creates a complex web of vulnerabilities that traditional DEI approaches may not fully address. Dr. Felicia Russell joins the conversation. She's an author, immigration scholar, and podcast host. Her book, Amplifying Black Undocumented Student Voices in Higher Education, explores real stories that showcase this complexity. I asked her about what she's seen and learned through her own work on this book.
There was one person, I think I named her Sasha in the book, we are the same age. And I remember just like my heart broke when she told me her story, because in high school, you know, she had similar grades to me, good grades, all of that. And then when she told her counselor about her status, her counselor told her she could not go to college, right? And so she graduated high school, worked under the table jobs for a while until 2012 when DACA came out, which was 2 years, something like that, 2 years after we graduated. And that's when she learned she could have gone to college this entire time, right? So this was, 2021, so what's 4 years ago? And yeah, she was just in school because she just had a completely different path than it ended. But not because she couldn't have had the same path, but because an educator told her otherwise, you know? And, you know, kids, we trust the educators. We think they're the experts, right? So they tell us something, we believe them.
Thank you for sharing that. So I want to talk about your own experience as a Black undocumented student on a college campus, this intersection of being Black in America, but you're also Jamaican. I know that must have been challenging when you're kind of navigating academic and social systems as well.
You know, what's interesting is that last year when I was on my doing the book tour, I was at a college in New York. And all of the students that were on the student panel, they were all Black students. They were from Jamaica, Nigeria, Haiti, Trinidad, and Tobago, and all of that. And it was the first time since I had been on a campus where the talk was centered around how to support undocumented students, where the student panel was majority Black students. I mean, I had never seen anything like that. And I realized in that moment that if I had grown up in New York or Miami or just somewhere on the East Coast, probably, I would have had a completely different experience than the one I had in California, which in California, the majority of the undocumented people I was surrounded by were Latinx. And so I thought, oh, it's so unique to be Black and undocumented. And it's not really that unique. You know, they exist. They're about 7% of the undocumented population in the U.S. And then in higher ed, the last numbers that we have from 2022, which I'm sure the 2023 numbers will come out soon, was that they were 15% of the 408,000 that was in higher ed. Right. And so we exist. But what I learned was from my participants, they had a lot more struggle with that, where just immigration, and I experienced this way, immigration was not really a topic that you discuss like in the Black centers or whatever. And if it did come up, it was one off and, you know, whatever. But they also experienced some like isolation in terms of like cultural just connection, right? I interviewed people from all over the U.S. And so if I interviewed people that were concentrated in California, completely different experience than, you know, because the students I was talking to at that New York school I mentioned, I was asking them about like in their undocumented space, if they feel other, and they're like, no, it's just us. What? Like, like So for them, it was like, that's who they were seeing themselves. And then for me, I wasn't seeing myself. But I think the point I was trying to get across is that immigration is a Black issue. And the more Black Americans start to care about immigration and get proximate to it, then we'll be able to build more bridges, right? Because there's always this tension kind of with Black immigrants and Black Americans. And I think part of it is from our parents, right? Like our parents are from these like other countries, like they're the majority or there, right? Like Black people are the majority. So no one's talking about race in those countries. But when you come here to America, people are talking about race because it is such a part of the fabric. And then you come and you're like, wait, what? What? Like, why? Right. So I had some really interesting conversations with some of the participants, and I felt like I was uniquely positioned to have those conversations with them because I grew up here. They grew up here, too. But like I grew up here, but I felt like my experience was of Black Americans. But then at home, it was Jamaican culture. Right. And so I understood where some of their like point of views came from, where like, some I had one participant was saying she didn't want to be identified as Black. And I said, why? You know, and she was like, because I'm Nigerian. And I'm like, you know, but you are Black. Like when you come in, when you walk into a room, people see you as Black. But I understood why she was saying it, because that's not how they define themselves in her country. Right. Or with like my Black American friends, when they get upset about like Black immigrants not wanting to identify themselves like that, I find great, you know, joy in saying, hey, but let me tell you why. Now, it doesn't mean that it's right, right? But let me tell you why they do this. And I had some really good conversations with some of the participants who really changed their perspective on that, where they were like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess that makes sense now, you know. But yeah, so I feel like I had both worlds, having a lot of majority Black American friends, feeling like I was having the Black American experience, but also knowing that I was an immigrant, I am an immigrant, and all of that. I think I had an easier time fitting into Black American spaces and Black immigrant spaces as opposed to fitting into undocumented spaces, if that makes sense.
This complexity of being Black and undocumented in America is juxtaposed with the reality that there is Black American culture and a separate American culture that is often biased against people of color. To understand more about the sociology of American culture, Dr. Reuben A. Buford May joins the conversation. He is a sociology professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and his research is at the intersections of community, race, gender, and class. From James Brown to Playboy Cardi, every generation has attempted to grapple with the stereotypes of Black identity. Dr. Buford May explains the history and complexity of this.
Yeah, so there are a number of ways. One of the ways was the complex of working twice as hard to demonstrate one's ability in this country and one's recognition. And so always going above and beyond, and in many ways this has a detrimental impact because most of us can hardly do one thing that we're supposed to do well, but then we are challenged in trying to do it twice as well. And that does have an impact, a negative impact on people. The other ways that they grapple with it, you know, is confronting identity. We have a lot of people who are mixed race in this country, who are biracial, and they are still having to deal with kind of the what it means to be a Black person in that context. So there are lots of ways that people are trying to figure out and establish their place in this country.
Mm-hmm. And I also want to talk about the history and complexities of this. And I know that's a very broad and open-ended question, but I know you mentioned mixed race people. Is there any other ways that you could kind of dive into that, of the overall history and complexities of this?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously you can think back all the way back to slavery and the pure bloodlines of people who came from the African continent and over time were slowly, I won't say integrated, but races began to mix through forced relationships and things like that. And so it created whole classes of people who were always trying to manage or figure out the racial color line. And it became recognized that people who were seen closer to white were seen as those who should have privilege. And they themselves embraced this idea. And so it created colorism in this country that Blacks have had to kind of think through or work through. And it's really complex because you can be, you know, you can look as though you are not mixed and recognize that you have a Black identity. And then you can look Black and feel like that you culturally, you fit somewhere else in some other place. And this is consistently brought about, especially with Blacks' engagement in institutions like schools, education, higher learning. You're constantly brought to think about those things because you are a representation of something that historically has been a challenge to American society, and it just continues to wear on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does continue to wear on you. Can you dive a little bit more deeper into that? You mentioned in that second half about in higher education and being Black and the complexities and the layers that we have as African Americans in that. What does this look like today?
Yeah. So one of the things is like at different times in history in this country, people have tried to address some of the situations or experiences of Black Americans. And the way they've done that is through legislation. So you had affirmative action, and then you have people broadening this idea of how to be inclusive, and you have DEI that emerges. And people now are using, in some ways, weaponizing the idea of DEI to critique or criticize whether people belong in higher education or in colleges and universities, and questioning how they actually got to become a part of the university. And so there's this stigma attached to race that is still connected to DEI, especially for people who are of the belief that things should be a little bit different than they have been most recently. And so it's forefront, right? It's in the forefront and raises questions for both the individual who is trying to sort through who they are and, you know, dealing with imposter syndrome. And then, you know, for those people who are trying to figure out how to address or engage Black people in a way that is not offensive or questions their intelligence.
Mm-hmm. And I think this duality leaves a dilemma for many Black migrants in this area too, who may try to find sociological ties with Black people in America, but also the social cost for just doing so. Can you talk about how Black immigrants have navigated this throughout history as well?
Yeah, so I have both personal experience with this and kind of sort of the educated, learned experience with this. My own understanding for a lot of people who come from nations that are Black, African diaspora, those nations, they arrive to America and come to understand very quickly that there are some distinctions between the way people are treated and that Black Americans are not treated as complete and full citizens. And many of them that make the transition attempt to integrate, but they try to retain parts of their culture and their history and their experiences that set them apart from Black Americans. So, you know, speaking your language, the foods, congregating or being with people who are from your country outside of the U.S. And so just trying to figure out, like, how do I as a person who is of a darker hue try to fit into a society that has made Black a questionable kind of identity? And how do I demonstrate that I am not like people who have lived here generations and have suffered all the oppression, that I'm something very different? And so this is constant tension with trying to place oneself both inside of a system that creates advantage or opportunities for people, but also keep themselves outside to the extent that they are clearly demarcated as different than being Black American.
Dr. Russell's book and advocacy centers around undocumented Black individuals in college, which she began as a college student herself. Now graduated and moving on in the world as a working adult, the dialogue team wanted to know if anything has changed.
Progress is slow, right? Progress is slow, always slow. But the immigration space is a pretty lonely space if you are Black or Asian or any other group that's not Latinx, just period. Just a lonely space because there's just not a lot of us in the space. One, because we don't see us, so we don't think we should get in there. And so that does not change necessarily. But if you end up at a really good organization or a good institution, you could have a different experience. So I've been having good experiences when I worked at the college campus. But I think the other piece is like, be prepared to be the expert in that area. So if you're Black, be prepared to know, like, you're gonna be the person, right? Like, you know, in class, if they're talking about something Black, they're like, oh, what do you think? That doesn't change. It might be a little bit more sophisticated, right? Where no one's calling on you, but it's kind of assumed that you might want to attack that area or something like that, or focus on that area. And then I think the big piece for me as I moved into the professional world was that I had to just kind of find my lane, right? When you're growing up, you think there's only a few ways you can affect change or be in the space. One, you see people protesting and they're like in DC and they're on the ground and you think that's the only way. And then you might be saying to yourself, like, I don't know if that's really me or my personality. It takes a while to figure out your lane. And so for me, I knew that wasn't me. I wasn't an activist in that way, but I knew I loved to tell stories and I loved to write, but I didn't know how that would be impactful in the space. And so that was the biggest thing I found out. And once I found that space, which is storytelling, I'm able to kind of continue to do the work that I want to do.
There are multiple layers of marginalization some Black undocumented individuals can often experience. Anti-Black racism within both mainstream society and immigrant communities, or even exclusion from racial justice movements that may focus predominantly on citizens. Dr. Felicia Russell tells us how, in her opinion, nothing has changed.
Yeah, it's a tough time. I think it's kind of unprecedented. So I don't think we know how to really deal with it yet. But I will say, I think we all right now, we just have to be calm and we have to be strategic and we have to lead with conviction, right? So calm, strategic, and just lead with conviction right now, because there's just a lot going on. It's unprecedented. I don't think anyone's prepared for it. I think for me, I had spent 21 years undocumented. Then, you know, like during that time I had DACA, and then finally last year I was able to adjust status, right? Which is how I was in Trinidad. And I think for me coming into this year, I was like, okay, finally I'm not undocumented anymore. So I can really like try to help everyone or whatever. And even though I'm not anymore, there's still this sense of like my side gives it away, like despair basically, right? Because it doesn't feel like anyone is safe at all. And so, you know, a lot of times people are like, you need the allies who are already on the other side to help you. And that's what I thought for me this year. And, you know, I feel like I'm going to continue to still do what I've been doing this year, which is inform and educate, and then use storytelling to shift the narrative about immigrants right now. And so that's what I've been doing. I launched a podcast this year titled Intersections with Dr. Russell, and it's really a podcast about storytelling, data, and myth busting. So I'm using those three buckets to really change the narrative around immigration. And that's been very good. And it's amazing to talk to all different types of people, like having really those conversations. I'm hoping they'll penetrate the spaces so we can focus less on the fear mongering that's happening and the divisiveness of the current climate, and really just listen to these stories, listen to the data, and use that to inform and equip ourselves. I think now is the time to stay kind and be informed.
As we look forward and many wonder, what does this mean for our country? Dr. Russell shares some things she wishes to see.
Whenever I go to universities I'm talking to students, they're like, how can I attract more Black undocumented students? One of the first questions I ask them is, what did your programming look like last year? Like, what type of events did you have, right? Because then you get to see if they even cater to any other group besides the Latinx group. The second piece is to center Black voices, right? So when you have events, not make the Black speaker a one-off or the secondary piece of it, but like the main part of the event. So center those voices, whether that's an event or storytelling. I don't know if you've ever been in any immigration course or any poli sci course on a college campus where they focus, you know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks on immigration. They don't diversify the stories. All right. So like the readings are all focused on the Latinx perspective. So diversify the readings, right? Think about different types of scholars and who are focused on different groups within that population. So that's more so for the faculty. And then the last piece would be to have cross-campus collaboration. And what that means is like, if you have a BSU or you have a Black Culture Center and then you have a Dream Center or an undocumented, they should be collaborating on events. Because if the BSU is saying, oh, we're putting on this event for Black History Month and it's going to center a Black immigrant, then that's going to get to different audiences than if only the Undocumented Student Center was putting on that event, right? Like it's going to get to different groups of students on campus. And so cross-campus collaboration is important with clubs and organizations or centers on campus. And all of those changes could apply to outside of higher ed as well. So when you think about outside of higher ed, when I talk about cross-campus collaboration, I'm talking about, you know, if you're in the nonprofit world, different organizations focus on different things should collaborate. Different topic areas should collaborate and put on events together. Or programming, same thing, right? Are you focused on any other group when you're telling immigrant stories, right? And what type of data are you pulling, right? When I talk about like in terms of a classroom, outside of a classroom, it's like, what type of data are you pulling? Are you doing work that centers the diversity of the community? So that's how we move outside of higher ed, right? We got to move beyond this one-sided narrative that only Latinx people are immigrants.
The debate over immigration hit a fever pitch in June, with President Trump deploying the National Guard to Los Angeles after clashes between crowds and protesters and immigration agents. In the same week, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker took aim at the Trump administration's immigration policies during his testimony before Congress. Sparks flew frequently at the hearing, including this exchange between Pritzker and Illinois' 15th District Congresswoman Mary Miller.
In light of the crimes that I have mentioned, do you stand by your policy of tying the hands of Illinois law enforcement? Yes or no, sir?
You know, Congresswoman Miller, I am to be lectured to by somebody
I'm
who extols
reclaiming
the virtue
my time.
Of
I'm
Adolf Hitler.
Time, yeah.
Before that exchange, Miller cited a deadly hit-and-run accident in Urbana in which an undocumented immigrant is accused of killing two young women. Pritzker brought up a comment Miller made 4 years ago, which seemed to praise a statement attributed to Adolf Hitler. Miller later apologized. Dr. Buford May leaves us with words of encouragement and what he hopes to see change as well.
Undocumented folks are in a precarious position to begin with. So people from outside of the country who are undocumented here for whatever reason, they are now having a heightened sense of kind of insecurity because of the actions that are being taken. And given that, people who are Black, I think, will have Black immigrants will have a greater sense of insecurity about their presence in space and place. And I think that's largely because if anyone's paying attention, that there are certain groups that are being started with, but that doesn't preclude other groups from being included in those who are then pursued aggressively to be deported from this country. So it doesn't create a sense of stability or security, but makes people feel much more vulnerable. Now, we can talk about policies that are related to why people should or should not feel that way, but the fact is that we're creating certain kinds of anxieties for people in those positions.
Mm-hmm. And you are a professor at the university, and I know it's a very real circumstance that you may have Black undocumented students. And as the counter perspective to the students, you know, if you do have any, how you perceive maybe the resources or struggles that they're going through during this time as well?
Certainly, if we were thinking about struggles that were only at the institutional level, I mean, we would be in a position as a university to address those struggles. But when things are mandated from top down, there would appear to be no cover from those things. And that includes the university's ability to intervene and do something for other people. But given the disposition of our current president, we are, when I say we, I mean American society, is unsure about how things are supposed to unfold and how people are supposed to engage. And so it does create a sense of instability for even people who have been here and been citizens all of their life. So it's just one of those states that we're in right now.
If you're interested in learning more about Dr. Felicia Russell's work, you can check out her podcast, Intersections with Dr. Russell, and her book, Amplifying Black Undocumented Student Voices in Higher Education.
Thank you all to Maria Jimenez, Dr. Russell, and Dr. Buford May.
For Dialogue, I'm Kennedy Vincent.